5% pay increase. You're not out of the woods yet, are you?
Well, we really value the nursing workforce. They're hugely important to the country, to the NHS, and to, you know, our ambition to turn the NHS around from the very difficult position that it's in now. So yesterday's vote is disappointing, but it's not a binding vote. It doesn't mean industrial action. And I'm sure that my colleague Wes Streeton, the Secretary of State, will do everything he can in dialogue with the nurses to make sure that they are part of the project he wants to do and we all want to do of getting the NHS back to where we want to.
Sure, but it's a bit of a way off, isn't it? The 22% pay deal offered to junior doctors, train drivers as well, 5% backdated rise for 22-23, and you know, pay agreements going forward as well. Have you shot yourselves in the foot on this one?
Well, you've got to watch comparing pay rises. You don't take 3 years' rise and compare it to 1 year's rise, which is sometimes what is done with these percentage figures. We have offered this year the first real terms pay increase to public sector workers that they've had for many years. When I say we offered, it was the recommendations of the pay review bodies. We abided by those because we recognised that was the right thing to do. That will mean public sector pay workers get a real terms pay rise for the first time in a long time. I don't think that's shooting ourselves in the foot. I think it's doing the right thing. We value the nurses, we value the doctors, we value the other workers in these services, and we want to get these services back working again.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that this was an attempt by you to draw a line under this whole issue. We spoke to Dr. Rob Lawrenson from the BMA last week. He's co-chair of the Resident Doctors Committee at the BMA. And he told us the junior doctors deal wasn't enough. They want a deal quite a bit above inflation next year, and they would be prepared to go on strike again if they don't get this. So that's what's coming down the line, isn't it? The strikes aren't over.
Well, we'll see what happens next year. Every pay settlement also has to be balanced with the public finances as a whole. They are in a difficult and tight position, as we know. We will always try and do right by the NHS workforce, be it doctors or nurses. But like everything else, when you're making a decision about spending in one area, in this case pay, then you have to take into account public spending in the round. And that's the choices any government has to make.
Yeah, I mean, but when you talk about these deals that have been struck with unions, let's talk about the ASLEF union train drivers. You give a pay rise to unions with no productivity conditions attached. This was accepted this month. No improvement in productivity or efficiency. I mean, when you look and you ask people who are trying to get around this country, especially at the weekend, they will say, well, what kind of madness is that? Because actually, you may have settled a dispute, but you're not improving my life as a commuter going forward.
Oh, well, look, one of the first pieces of legislation that we've passed as a new government is huge reform and change in the rail industry. We are going to bring the rail industry back into public ownership. We're going to integrate all the ticketing services. We have major reforms in the future planned for the rail industry. So I'm afraid I don't accept that this is just settling a pay dispute with no bigger plan to improve the railways. Improving the railways is a big part of what we plan to do over the next few years.
But to do
it's
that,
much
it would all have to be back under government ownership, wouldn't it, to make sure that happens? And at the moment, there's nothing put in there to sort of mitigate cost savings, efficiency and technology, all the things that the unions have said.
It will be more efficient because we've got a multiplicity of companies, a multiplicity of ticketing arrangements. We're going to bring some coherence to the railway after this confusing picture for many years. And I think that's to the benefit of passengers and to the benefit of the country. So there's big changes and big reforms planned for the railway. And by the way, while we're on the subject, bus services too, because we are changing legislation on that to allow local franchising to be made easier. So on both for bus passengers and rail passengers, we are planning big changes in time, to in try time, to improve that, the services.
In time, that's the point I'm making. Let's just talk briefly about the winter fuel payments. Non-binding vote was expected yesterday, but delayed until tomorrow. This is how it went down in the hall yesterday.
This is a really busy conference, and we are trying to accommodate as much as we can.
I mean, people inside the hall thought it was a cop-out. It is a cop-out, isn't it, delaying this vote? You just don't want to face the criticism from your own side.
Well, I'm a bit of a long-time server at Labour Party conference, and I've been through many of these rouseabout resolutions in the past. Look, I understand why some people in the Labour Party, and indeed outside it, would rather that we hadn't had to take this decision. In a way, I feel that way myself. But, you know, we find ourselves in a very difficult position where the previous government had spent the whole of the reserves for this year within 3 months.
But it was a political choice, wasn't it? You didn't have to focus on pensioners, but you chose to.
Well, we had to, you know, it wasn't just pensioners. We had to cancel some transport projects. And in among it, we also made sure that we kept a triple lock, which will mean a rise in the pension of an estimated £1,700 or so over the course of the parliament. That's what protects the basic value.
Okay, but it doesn't help people. It doesn't help people this winter, does it? And are you comfortable with the fact that there will be pensioners listening to this who are going to suffer, you know, this winter because of this cut?
The triple lock does help people this year because it means a rise of about £400 or more in the basic state pension over the next year. So the triple lock does apply this year. Look, it's okay. A difficult decision. I understand that, and I know there'll be opposition to some of these things, but let me make another point about this. Getting the public finances sorted is an inescapable duty of government. You just can't run away from it. And we know what happened when people tried to run away from it in the past. Everybody suffers when that happens. We will protect the value of the basic state pension through the triple lock. We will get the public finances sorted. And as we do that, that is a platform for getting the investment the country needs, which generates the wealth that we need for the public services and which makes the public better off. And this is the argument that will be at the heart of the first speech we will hear from a Labour Prime Minister to a Labour conference for 15 years today. It's a big moment for us. It's a big moment for the country.
Pat McFadden, thank you for joining us. Minister for the Cabinet Office, joining us from the conference in Liverpool. You'll hear that speech later today on 5 Live.
Also, we are hoping to speak to the Prime Minister this afternoon to bring you that interview tomorrow here on 5 Live Breakfast. These things are always a bit unpredictable, but that is the intention. That's what we've been told is going to happen. So hopefully we'll get a few minutes with him this afternoon and you'll hear it tomorrow here on the show. But we'd like to know, what questions would you like us to put to Keir Starmer, please? 85058. What is the one thing that you think the Prime Minister needs to address in your life right now? You can text us that and we'll try and gauge where you are all at the moment and what you think the most pressing issues are for him to take on board. Thank you for that in advance. 7:15.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as The Coming Storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
5 Live Breakfast. In my opinion.
In my opinion.
In my opinion.
And in my opinion.
Today's In My Opinion is all about homework. Now that we're back in the thick of it for the new term, have a listen to what our guest thinks.
I'm Dr. Jo Castellino, Head of Science at a Secondary School and the author of The Homework Conundrum. In my opinion, most homework teachers set in schools is rubbish. It is either too much, too little, too hard, too easy, or it doesn't help students with their learning. There is a way forward to make homework effective and worth the while of students, teachers and families, but it takes a lot of careful thought and time.
Five Live Breakfast. The voice of the UK.
So we'll speak to Joe before 8, but you're texting us now to tell us what you think about the homework that's set for your children, how you manage it as a teacher. This one here, why are we constantly telling adults they shouldn't respond to work emails or work from home without getting paid, but we insist on our kids doing it, says Andy. This one here as well, my daughter is 6. She already has homework twice per week with an optional family activity to do over the weekend. Additionally, there are spellings to learn for a weekly test, an expectation to read every day, and additional multiplication table tests to start after half term. It amounts to doing something every night and at the weekend. It is a lot for a busy family who try to raise a healthy, active child, and we are unwilling to compromise her participation in after-school activities, but it's tough. I'm glad we only have one child. I'm not sure there is value in homework beyond teaching her that you have to work hard, which I'm not sure needs to come this early. My wife and I dread homework and the inevitable tantrums that accompany it.
James in Bristol, morning James, says this. Rachel is totally correct. Achievement is correlated with homework, not a consequence of it. There is an overwhelming body of research, including the Education Endowment Fund, the EEF, the largest independent education research body in the UK, that proves homework is at best ineffective and at worst an unnecessary distraction that polarises parents and wastes teachers' time, says James.
Paul in Wolverhampton says, my daughter has a school laptop and the majority of homework is issued on this, has to be uploaded on completion. Parents then have an app that shows all the homework, deadline dates and confirms when it has been completed. This enables a bit more planning and ensures homework doesn't get forgotten, which all sounds very efficient, but actually also brings me out in a cold sweat because it's just another thing to manage.
It's another
and
thing.
There is a question about whether we want children to spend more time on screens and is it appropriate to set homework on that, which is a whole other debate. But yes, please let us know what you think about all of that, 85058, or you can send a voice note, 0808 599 693.
We're going to have more on the way on the allegations against the Harrods owner, former owner Mohammed Al-Fayed. The BBC has heard from a former boss of Harrods about his abhorrent behaviour. E-bikes as well, looking at why there's been a big rise in the number of illegally modified e-bikes being seized by police.
And I love this story. Do you remember the boat in Belfast, the cruise liner, that some people have bought apartments on to live in, right? So this is a lifelong thing. It's about to go off on a round-the-world cruise and it's stuck in Belfast for repairs. Well, we're going to hear from a couple who got engaged after being stuck there.
Oh, yeah, that's such a beautiful story.
Know each other beforehand. But, yeah, circumstances obviously brought the two of them together. So we'll speak to them. And do keep your facts coming in about the place you live, the boring facts after Hatfield was named as the most boring place in the UK. And by the way, we spoke to a man from Hatfield. Someone just says here, I don't think he's helping. Someone else says, I've been to Hatfield many times. It is boring.
Yeah.
And Em in Stretford just switched on, listening to this guy extolling the virtues of Hatfield. I was born and bred in Hertfordshire. Hatfield is duller than dull.
There's so many.
I thought Mike from Hatfield did a terrific job.
Yes. Well, he said, why would Elton John play in a boring place?
Why would Bublé turn up if it was boring, he said.
I don't know. I'm sure that's like, he says, is it boring? Well, I'm not going there. Gareth in North Shields. I'm originally from Whitehaven in Cumbria. It's the only place in the UK to be invaded by the United States a couple of hundred years ago. They came ashore. Everyone in the town was drunk because it was raining. They couldn't light any fires, so they left. I think that's quite a fascinating
that
fact.
That is. That's Gareth. An exciting fact, not a boring one. This is boring. Stephen in Leeds says, Buslingthorpe in Leeds is the longest place now name without a repetitive letter.
That's
apparently
dull. That is dull.
Great fact.
Well done. Boring facts. Keep them coming in. 85058. We love to read them.
Let's talk about cricket now. England's men facing Australia at Chesterless Street later in a must-win ODI if they're to salvage anything from this series. Australia are 2-0 up in the three-match series, so they can win with a victory today. I mean, they've won anyway, haven't they? England's Adil Rashid, though, is staying optimistic.
Obviously, we've not started well in the series. 2-0 down, we know we've got to win the next three to win the series. So it's going to be a tough challenge, but that's something that we're looking forward to. And hopefully, like I said, we can, you know, show our character and bounce back. We've got to take it game at a time, step out in time and let things unfold, and hopefully we can get a win.
Five Lives' Henry Moran will be across the match for Test Match Special for us. Morning, Henry.
Good morning. Let me tell you, Hatfield's increased its population by 12,000 since the start of the millennium. It can't be that bad.
Fascinating fact to add to our bucket of fascinating facts. Thank you very much. I knew you wouldn't let me down.
Forgive me, but no, it's a huge game for England at this, because there's a real sense Rachel, of pressure on not just the performances that we've seen the first couple of matches, but not sort of the ethos behind this team, because it's all been about over the last 10 years, playing with freedom, playing as though, you know, you're not burdened by the sense and fear of failure. And the last couple of matches, they've not quite got that message right, I don't think. England have been in positions in both of the games. At Trent Bridge, they were 213 for two with the bat, and then collapsed horribly. Headingley, they did really well with the ball. They had Australia at 161 for six, and then the game fell away from them again. And on both occasions with the bat, this real blueprint of how they've had so much success in the last decade, it's just not happened for them. Yes, they're inexperienced, but I think they've got to find a way of putting on a good performance today, even if it's a slightly gritty, ugly performance, but something that is just going to say, yeah, we've got a little bit more about us, and we're not willing just to sort of roll over and be beaten by, yeah, a really good Australian side. But I think England fans want to see just a little bit more.
Yeah, the cricket equivalent of parking the bus a bit, maybe. I know Marcus Triscothic is in temporary charge, and then Brendan McCullum takes over because he's taking over all formats, isn't he? But I don't think we can lay this at the door of Triscothic, can we? Are there issues going back with England's one-day side for some time?
I think the thing that we need to look at is the experience compared with Australia between the two squads. If you look at what England have got in their lineup compared to Australia, it is very, very different. And a quite good illustration of this is England's number 11, Adil Rashid, who we just heard from there, has coming into the series scored more runs than anyone else in England's entire lineup, because he's been around for longer and everyone else is reasonably new, or the majority of them are quite inexperienced. So there is that factor. Australia, they're world champions. They've now won their last 14 one-day internationals. So they're a very good side. And I think it's partly the fact that England have set really high standards for themselves in the last few years. And so there is inevitably quite high expectations. Marcus Triscothic, he's not going to necessarily see this as it is his responsibility, and it is part of the development process for this England side. I think that what will probably be the determining factor in terms of where people see this has gone wrong is England not necessarily getting the opportunity to play the format very often. Jamie Smith, this hugely talented player who's done so much in the test side to make a name for himself this year. He's 24 years old and he's not played a 50 over match domestically for 2 years. And that's, you know, that's not really a sort of bedding a ground base for somebody to start their 50 over career at an international level. So they are finding their way a little bit. I think England fans just want to see them find their way with perhaps a little bit more caution and understand you can take a little bit longer to get your innings going.
And what's Harry Brooks' role in all of that as captain then?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because Harry Brook has been thrust into the spotlight in the last 12 months simply because he's this prodigious talent and everybody's seen that across the formats. And he is somebody they've earmarked as having real cricket intelligence, they speak about, reading the game brilliantly well and knowing exactly how to get the best from his players. We spoke to him after the first game at Trent Bridge, and this quote that has gone around all over the place where he said, you know, if we get caught on the boundary, then who cares? And I think he's got that clumsily wrong. I don't think he means who cares, we don't care, we're just turning up and having a laugh and whatever. I think what he is trying to do is reflect that Owen Morgan message from 10 years ago is, look, don't worry about failure, back yourself and it'll come good because you've got the ability to do well. I think that's what he's trying to say. But there is always the danger when teams don't win matches, fans are turning up on cold days in September, having spent a lot of money and taking time off work and seeing teams losing. They start thinking, well, hold on a minute. If you're now telling me you don't really care, then what am I doing wasting my time and my money? So England have got to find a way of getting, if not the messaging better, then certainly the performance on the field just showing a little bit more grit, patience, and showing that they've got the fight that can potentially turn this series around, because they've got the ability.
Well, I was just going to say that, because there was an error when I set out this story. I said Australia 2-0 up in the three-match series. It's a five-match series.
It is.
So there is a chance for redemption. It might be a long shot, but there is a chance.
Well, there is, and we've got to hope that the weather plays ball as well, because it was a horrible day yesterday. You would have heard in that Adil Rashid interview the sound of bat on ball inside the indoor nets, because England had to train inside yesterday. Both teams did. But the forecast today, we should start on time at 12:30. It then gets a little bit more showery as we go through the afternoon. But we've got to hope that we'll see enough cricket to see a full game in. Yeah. So there is hope in that. And then we've got matches Lords on Friday, Bristol on Sunday, 29th of September, for an international, which is late in the summer. But there is still time for England.
Yeah, someone's complaining here. It's saying, doesn't the world of cricket know that the football season has started? But let's try and extend that summer as much as we can, even if the weather's not playing. Thank you very much, Henry.
Cheers.
Henry Moran, who is across that one-day international against Australia for Five Live. Sorry, for Test Match Special. Ball-by-ball commentary is on Five Sports Extra. With the Test Match Special team, the coverage starts at 12:30. It's 7:27.
Let's get more now on the allegations of sexual abuse against the late owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed. Former Harrods chief executive James McArthur has spoken to the BBC and said that he witnessed abhorrent behaviour from him, but not sexual abuse. Our correspondent Ben King has been following developments. Morning, Ben.
Morning, hello.
So for people new to this story, tell us about the allegations against Mr. Fayed.
So Mohammed Al-Fayed was the high-profile Egyptian businessman who owned Harrods from 1985 to 2010. And he died last year at the age of 94. And last week, the BBC published a documentary called Predator at Harrods, which detailed the horrific experiences of more than 20 women who told their stories of sexual assault and rape while working at Harrods at the hands of Mr. Al-Fayed. And since that documentary was broadcast, dozens more have come forward with similar stories.
And what are former executives, this new line today, what have they been saying?
Well, over the past couple of days, I've been trying to contact as many people as possible who were directors at Harrods during the period that Mr. Al-Fayed owned it. Yesterday, we heard from Andre Maeder, who is currently chief executive of Selfridges, which has that famous department store on Oxford Street in London, as well as two stores in Manchester, one in Birmingham. Now, he worked at Harrods for 6 years, from 1995 to 2002. He was chief retail officer. And he said he was horrified to see the documentary about Mr. Al-Fayed's alleged crimes that the BBC broadcast last week. And he said he never heard or saw anything of this abhorrent behaviour. And we've also heard from James McArthur. He was there for a much shorter period, just 10 months, in 2008. But that was a significant period because it was the time that the Metropolitan Police was investigating the case of a 15-year-old girl who said she was sexually assaulted in a Harrods boardroom by Mr. Al-Fayed. Now, Mr. McArthur says that Mr. Al-Fayed's behaviour was abhorrent in many ways, and he refers to his sense of humour and his personal conduct, and said his personal relationships were mostly dysfunctional. But he, Mr. McArthur, wasn't aware of any sexual abuse by him. And that's despite the fact that the case of the girl was covered in a lot of newspapers. He says he doesn't recall that. And there was quite a high turnover of executives at Harrods during Mr. Al-Fayed's ownership. I mean, he was clearly a difficult man to work with, to put it mildly. So there's still a lot of people out there who we haven't heard from and who still have questions to answer.
And Ben, obviously Harrods, different people running it now. Any comment from them?
That's right. Harrods is now owned by the Gulf state of Qatar. But last night the BBC heard from another survivor of abuse at Harrods who says that she was assaulted by Mr. Al-Fayed with the collusion of some managers at Harrods. And she said that some of the people who facilitated the abuse are still working at Harrods or at other companies. And part of her reason for speaking out was to help bring them to justice. Now, there's no implication that she's referring to the two names of directors that we just heard. But Harrods says it is utterly appalled by the allegations of abuse perpetrated by Mohammed Al-Fayed. We condemn them in the strongest possible terms. As part of the due diligence, there is an ongoing internal review supported by external counsel looking at whether any current staff were involved in any of the allegations, either directly or indirectly. And Harrods says that this review has been going on since last year. And Harrods says it is also in direct communication with the Metropolitan Police to ensure that we are offering our assistance with any of their relevant inquiries.
Thank you for the update, Ben. Our correspondent, Ben King. After 8:30, we're going to be speaking to the former Victims Commissioner for England and Wales, Dame Vera Baird, on this story. 7:30.
Do you know what cheered me up today?
What?
I didn't know Bake Off was back tonight. Proper autumn feel, hearing that music.
Oh, it is lovely. It is lovely.
The only problem being it goes on so late now. So, because it goes past 9 o'clock, that's my absolute cut-off time, pumpkin time for me. Yeah. So I don't stay up to see who's actually out.
Right.
And who Star
then
Baker
you have
is.
To kind of avoid it the next day.
No. I just look on social media first thing.
Oh, okay.
Morning. Yeah.
But not
bothered. I've been scouring through their posts to see who the new competitors are in this series. And, you know, as ever, they look like a lovely bunch. And, excuse me, that is the thing about Bake Off is generally it allows you to spend time in the company of like a group of just really sort of nice people doing nice things.
Do you know what all the reality TV shows? Have you been watching My Mum, Your Dad?
No, but
oh,
people love
brilliant.
It.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Then?
Yes, it is. A new series
on
now.
I haven't watched the new one. Okay.
I mean, it's just people's stories.
Yeah.
That's the most interesting thing. It doesn't matter kind of what they're doing, but it's how they cast these shows that is brilliant.
Plus cake.
Which
is always a bonus.
Yeah.
So the 12 new recruits include a car mechanic, a fashion designer, and tonight they're going to be asked to make a loaf cake, followed by an illusion cake in the technical. That's quite hard.
Oh, yeah. Sounds
hard.
Week
one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Somebody has written here, not my words, let's hope they can rise to the occasion and avoid a soggy bottom.
Bye-bye. Yeah, it's great. You did make a Jaffa cake once that I ate, which
yes,
I was so impressed by.
When they did the Jaffa cake challenge, they were really nice. I mean, not mine in particular, but actually the homemade ones versions were surprisingly tasty.
Well, I mean, I don't know how you did it. And it was midweek. That's what I was most impressed by. Barely find my pants for the next day.
Still to come, keep your texts coming in. Not on that, Claire's pants, but this...
In my opinion, most homework teachers set in schools is rubbish.
So are you settling into the homework routine once again? Are you tearing your hair out with it? What is the standard of homework like from your children's schools? 7:33.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Here are the news headlines. The Labour Cabinet Minister, Pat McFadden, has told Five Live Breakfast that getting the public finances sorted is an inescapable duty of being in government. He was defending cuts to the winter fuel allowance for pensioners.
Mr McFadden was speaking to us ahead of Sir Keir Starmer's speech at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool later, in which he'll warn of a shared struggle ahead. But the Prime Minister will also say there is light at the end of the tunnel for Britain.
Israeli airstrikes on Hezbollah targets continued overnight as thousands of people fled their homes in southern Lebanon. The country's Health Ministry says almost 500 people were killed yesterday. Lebanon has accused Israel of indiscriminate attacks.
And a former Harrods boss says he witnessed abhorrent behaviour from the late owner, Mohammed Fayed, but he was not aware of any sexual abuse. James MacArthur, who was chief executive for 10 months in 2008, told the BBC his time at Harrods was unpleasant.
Let's take a look at the weather. Matt's back.
I certainly am. Thanks, Claire. Well, more wet weather to come across the UK through Wednesday and into Thursday, certainly later on Wednesday. Nowhere near as heavy as the rain we saw recently, but the impact from that will still be felt today, even though much of England Wales have a drier day. Lots of cloud at the moment, patchy rain or drizzle to get the day underway, but slowly brightening up from the north and west. Most will see some sunny spells during the afternoon. An isolated light shower can't be ruled out. Northern Ireland, sunshine and showers today. Best of the drier weather as the cloud breaks up will be towards the south and east. Showers most frequent in the north and west. And for Scotland, showery rain pushing its way southwards across the country. Some in the far north and in the far west will stay dry. Cool in the north, 10 to 13, 13 to 18 in the south.
So the weather causing all sorts of problems out on the roads,
it
hasn't
is.
It been? Has it calmed down a bit, Orna?
It has calmed down. There's quite a bit of residual flooding left out there. Localised flooding, though. And the M8 and West Lothian queues on the eastbound side at Junction 3 at Livingston. So there's an accident. It's blocking one of the lanes. The queue's about to 5 at Shotts. The M60's busy because there was an accident a while ago, anti-clockwise, Junction 14 at the East Lancs Road. But the queues go back to Simister Island and onto the M62 West to Junction 19 at Hayward. M6 queue still there passing Birmingham. It starts at 7 at Great Bar. There was a breakdown earlier. Southbound M40 still queuing at Junction 10. That's at Brackley. A breakdown there on the southbound side. All lanes are open. The M1 flooded at Junction 8 at Hemel Hempstead, so one lane closed, but you can get past in the other three lanes heading north. The M2 in Kent, westbound at 3 at Chatham. The barrier repairs still underway. One lane closed. Traffic isn't doing too badly considering Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
So Katie's here with the sport. Bad news for Rodri, for him personally, actually, because when you get an injury like that, we don't know the precise details, do we? But we know that it's going to be a long recovery.
Yeah, early reports
definitely suggesting it's not good. He had to be subbed off. It was quite early on in the first half of that draw with Arsenal at the Etihad. He was clutching his knee. As you say, Rach, the club yet to confirm how long he could be out for. But if it's anything like an ACL, MCL, something to, you know, a really serious injury with his knee, it could be 6 months minimum. And it feels like the timing is almost quite significant as well, because it was only last week that he was saying to the media that players were close to striking. He said it was because of the increasing number of fixtures each season. He actually missed City's first three league games of this campaign after needing more rest, because he's had 63 appearances for club and country in the last year. And significantly, City lost four of the five games that he missed for them last year as well. This was Rory Smith on the Monday Night Club.
In the run of normal fixtures, City will be fine. Where it makes a difference is if Rodri's out for a long period of time and you have to play a Champions League semi-final without Rodri. That's when it becomes an issue. But for the vast majority of Premier League games, Croatian international with, what, 70, 80 caps, Mateo Kovacic, formerly of Real Madrid and Chelsea, he can probably fill in.
Yeah, they're actually in action tonight as well in the Carabao Cup. Elsewhere, the American consortium, the Friedkin Group, have reached an agreement now. They're going to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in Everton Football Club, subject to approval still. And Leeds United planning to expand Elland Road, the capacity up to 53,000.
Now, you want to talk about a snooker player, outspoken, slightly grumpy, complaining about conditions at a snooker tournament, but it's not Ronnie O'Sullivan.
I know, madness, right? This is world number three, Mark Allen. Listen to this. He says, the conditions, so he was playing at the British Open last night, absolutely embarrassing. He says the table he played on should be burned. He said the Cheltenham venue was cold and humid and the cushions were unplayable. And he won the match. This was after winning the match. Elsewhere, though, defending champion Mark Williams out. Judd Trump is through. He beat Robert Milkins. And he's now one century away from reaching a career 1,000.
It's special. I mean, only other two players and two of the greatest of all time. So to be up there amongst them would be very special. I just don't want to be amongst them. I want to be one day the best in taking all their records on my own.
In cricket, Glamorgan won the One Day Cup for the second time in the last 4 years. They beat Somerset by 15 runs. It was a match reduced to 20 overs. England take on Australia in the third ODI at Chester Le Street at lunchtime. Commentary to come on Sports Extra. And the Rugby Union Weekly latest podcast is out. Great listeners ever. The team pick out Bath scrum half Ben Spencer is one to potentially watch for England this autumn. But Rachel, Danny Kerr not happy. Now, the reason why is he's seen his valuation on Fantasy Premiership Rugby compared to the likes of Marcus Smith and Finn Russell, who are valued at £10 million.
I'm going to let you know where I'm at. I'm only 4 mil. Which, when I saw it, I was like, what is going on here?
Maybe think, I don't know, do we need to do some breakfast valuations, or that could go quite downhill, couldn't it?
Yeah. The thing is, he'd be a really good value buy, because he's not going to start every game. Yeah. But he's going to have an impact when he comes on. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Nailed it. But you can listen to more of that.
Nothing wrong with fitting in the value slot.
Exactly. And I'm sure he scores highly in other areas. Mm-hmm. We'll just have to find what those are. But yeah, listen in BBC Sounds app, where you can get more. And you can also join the team's fantasy league as well.
Thank you, Katie. It is 7:39 Tuesday morning. Let's bring you a bit more now on the situation in Lebanon after people living in the south of the country have been fleeing their homes because of extensive Israeli airstrikes. The Lebanese health ministry say nearly 500 people were killed. That includes 35 children and more than 1,500 have been injured.
Well, roads heading north were clogged with traffic as civilians tried to escape the deadliest cross-border escalation between Israel and Hezbollah in nearly two decades. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bichet is in Beirut.
All night, people were still trying to reach Beirut, leaving, you know, towns and villages in the south of the country. We met families who were carrying only a few bags with some belongings. They described to us the intensity of those attacks yesterday. Now, schools have been turned into shelters here. The government is saying that tens of thousands of people have been displaced because of this violence in the south. And a government minister described what happened yesterday as Israeli atrocities, because the government is saying that most of the sites that were hit were residential sites. And again, what the Israeli authorities are saying is that they targeted Hezbollah positions. They say that Hezbollah was using those houses to hide rockets and drones and weapons, using the civilian population as human shields. But we're seeing the impact of those attacks, the deadliest day in Lebanon since at least 2006, the last time Hezbollah and Israel fought a war. And we met lots of people yesterday here in Beirut who fear that they could be seeing a similar situation again, a wider war between Israel and Hezbollah that could, you know, bring destruction to many parts of this country.
There we go. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bechega in Beirut. We'll bring you updates on that developing situation here on 5 Live. It's 19 minutes to 8. Now, the number of illegally modified electric bikes seized by UK police forces has risen significantly in the first 8 months of 2024. 27 of 46 forces responded to a Freedom of Information request by the Press Association showing 937 e-bike seizures compared with 511 for the previous 12 months. Earlier, I spoke to Sergeant Stuart Ford, who leads the City of London Police Cycle Response Unit, and he shared how these bikes are modified.
Many of the ones you see, especially by the delivery-style riders, are normal bikes that you can buy in any store. And what they'll do is they'll go and buy a kit online with a throttle and a lithium battery, or sometimes two lithium batteries, and then a rear motor that fits on the rear wheel. And what they're doing by just holding the throttle open, these types of bikes will go up to sort of 30, 40 miles an hour quite easily. And obviously they're not pedalling, they're not pedal assist, they're just a throttle and go.
Right. Well, let's talk to Ash Medforth, whose daughter was hit by an electric scooter when she was just 5. Now, Ash went on to set up the campaign Just Stick a Reg on It. Ash joins us now. Morning, Ash.
Good morning.
So this sounds awful. What happened with your daughter?
I was in my cargo bike and we were just riding down Holloway Road, and we came up to park. My daughter came running out from the cargo bike and got hit by a scooter. The guy went down the road and then came back and insisted on trying to get some money out of me for the repair of his scooter because my daughter was running around like a nuisance on a pavement, allegedly.
What happened to her? How was she?
Concussion and a broken rib.
Right. And she had a helmet on, didn't she?
And a week of hell for me.
Right. And she had a helmet on, didn't she?
Yes. I mean, it was smashed in. I mean, there are pictures online of it. But I can't remember. I think it's Hammond High. It's in Hammond High where I live in London.
Yeah. And I understand the doctor that saw your daughter said if she hadn't been wearing that, it could have been a lot worse for her.
Yeah, it was the side of the edge of the handlebar went into the helmet.
Mm. How fast do you reckon this person was going?
About 15, 20 miles an hour. But she was 5. It's it's precautions, isn't it?
Mm. So you set up
miles an hour for a 5-year-old. You're going to do more damage because they're smaller and more easily damaged.
Absolutely. So presumably, I mean, was she hit on the road? Was she hit on the pavement? Where did that happen?
It was on the pavement, yeah.
Right.
She came running around a blind spot on the pavement.
Yeah, yeah. So we're talking about these souped-up electric bikes today, and they get modified and they can go very, very fast indeed, and that is not legal because you're essentially turning it into a moped. And
I run Shadowworks, which is a government consultancy for all of this. We develop all the technology to stop this. We develop all the battery systems, and we develop safe systems for the DVLA to test and use as benchmarks. So, ironically, I do the opposite side of it as well.
Right, but what
we're actually the company who developed the Stinger gun. It was designed to stop them where the police could actually fire a gun at it and stop them. Where the company that developed that.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'm just making it clear to the audience.
The top secret company that develops that type of stuff.
Right. Okay. Sounds very James Bond. I just for the audience who didn't hear the first interview with the police officer, he's saying basically they soup up, they put these motors and throttles on these bikes, and therefore, they are mopeds, so they're not insured for them. What do you think needs to change then? What is your campaign?
My campaign is for scooters and e-bikes. There is a problem on this one, though, and I've spoken to many government ministers and David Davis from PACS, a Parliamentary Advisory Committee for Transport Safety, who I work with quite often. The big problem here is, first of all, as you said, they're mopeds, and we need to take that as a starting point. A moped's top speed that it's allowed is 28 miles an hour. It also, it doesn't class, in a moped, the classification doesn't specify that you have to have a seat. So that includes, so that would be a scooter as well. So, you know, when I see these delivery riders magically sailing up hills without pedaling, it's quite funny. So it's mainly the reason they're doing this is because they don't want to pay the road tax insurance, and they basically get a free pass to have a moped without any of that. And they also don't have to pay petrol on it or anything like that, because they just charge them up and that then go. Many of them are very unsafe and actually set on fire as well, because these kits are not the best quality. One of the ways to, if we don't get a grip on it, because we've also got the problem with sewer runs as well, which is either the very high power ones that all the thieves are using in London, they're about £5,000-6,000 each. So, and they are really just motorbikes, because they go way over above 28. So they're classified as a motorbike, basically. What we need to do is we need to say, well, okay, if you're going to have these things, they're classified as mopeds, you're going to have to stick registration plates on them, the manufacturers, so the police can identify what is and what isn't.
Okay. So what's the reluctance to do that then? You're inside government quite a lot.
The obstacle to doing this is that it would work with e-scooters, because currently all e-scooters are illegal. So you'd be basically saying any e-scooter that's legal from this point, you can put a registration. Unfortunately, under legislation, you could say, yes, okay, all new e-bikes must have a registration plate on it. However, that would be new e-bikes, because you couldn't force existing e-bike users to modify their bikes, because some of it could be quite costly. So then the police would be faced with an impossible task, that because they would have some e-bikes with registration plates and some bikes legally without registration plates.
And so have you thought that bit through? We're running out of time, but what about that? What about that anomaly? Is there a way round it?
No, there is no way round that, because you cannot force existing users. There's tens of thousands of them to put registration. You can do it with e-scooters. You can't do it with e-bikes. So that is not a solution for this problem.
Okay.
The only solution for this is setting up a dedicated enforcement team and just drive, you know, for a year, drive them out of existence.
Ash, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Ash
Medforth there, whose daughter was hit by an electric scooter. His campaign is Just Stick a Reg on It. But as he's saying, it wouldn't work. And this is talking about electric scooters. It wouldn't work on these bikes. He's saying you just got to, you know, up the enforcement and get them off the roads. Your views welcome. 850-58.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Keeping you up to date with everything Formula One.
It has been utter dominance for Lando Norris, who wins the Singapore Grand Prix.
It was an amazing race. A few too many close calls. I'm a bit out of breath, but very fun one.
Next up, Austin, Texas, and an intense 6-race sprint to the end of the year. The Checkered Flag Podcast. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Five Live Breakfast, in my opinion.
In my opinion.
In my opinion.
And in my opinion.
So we are well into the first term of the new school year, and you've probably got the homework piling up already. Well, today's In My Opinion is all about that, and our guest today thinks most of it is actually just a bit rubbish. Joe Castellino is Head of Science at a secondary school in Wakefield and author of The Homework Conundrum. Hiya, Joe.
Hi, good
Hello.
Morning.
What's wrong with most of the homework our children get set then? What's your issue with it?
Well, I think a lot of the time the homework that is being set is not really thought of. So the purpose behind the homework has not been considered carefully enough because of the lack of time. Not blaming teachers. I've done this myself. So it's either too much, or there's very little of it, or it's too hard or too easy. It's basically almost busy work, and not as much thought sometimes goes into it.
So what does the perfect piece of homework look like?
It looks different for different students, actually. That's the issue, I think. We have recently in teaching really considered how students learn. And we have, you know, modified the way we teach and really think carefully about how we teach in the classroom. All of those principles can be applied to homework as well. But because of the lack of time, that doesn't always happen. Now, a perfect piece of homework for one student will not be a perfect piece of homework for another. I have set what I think is really good homework to my classes. But if I just gave the exact same piece of homework to everybody, that wouldn't work. There are, of course, having said all that, there are certain principles that would make homework.
Yeah, it's unrealistic, isn't it? If you're a school teacher, secondary school teacher with several classes of 30 kids, you're never going to be able to set individual homework tasks for each of those.
No, but because we have classes of students where we get to know them. So, you know, we've already been a few weeks in now and we started to know our students really well through the classroom, how we question them and how we interact with them. And as you get to know them, you can start to give them homework where there is a little bit of flexibility as well. So, for example, what I set is with the homework, I want my students to learn some facts, let's say. I teach science at For them, it's really important that they remember lots of stuff. There's just far too much content in science. So I give them homework where they're trying to learn some things. These are things that I have already taught them, but they're just practicing that on their own, giving them that independent study as well. So if they do that regularly, they are going to feel more competent in the classroom. They'll feel more confident in the classroom. And then it's in the classroom where I can dial it up a bit.
I understand what you're saying, but isn't that what most homework is about, consolidating what they've already learned? How are you saying it should be done differently?
Actually, that is not what a lot of the homework is at the moment. It is in certain subjects, definitely. So maths has traditionally set lots of practice homework. But I personally, in science, have set homework where students had to make a poster or students had to do something completely different where it doesn't actually link with what they're doing in the classroom. And one of the main issues with that is because we don't have as much time as teachers.
Well, let me give you some of the feedback we've had from our audience this morning. And people sort of broadly divide into, yes, agreeing with you, we need to do homework, but it should be more targeted. But a number of our listeners say there really isn't any point to homework at all. It doesn't benefit. No, no, no to homeworks is this one. Schools have children all day, 5 days a week to educate them. Evenings and weekends should be absolutely free for sport and other activities chosen by the family. Life is hectic and stressful for teachers and families alike. It's important to keep simple things to keep things simple with room for hobbies, creativity, reading and play. What do you think? What do you think, Joe, about that?
Yeah, I mean, I completely understand where that's coming from. I've got I have an 8-year-old son who plays a lot of football, and I completely agree that they need time to do other things as well. But in secondary schools, we have so much content to teach. Now, I can give you an example of what happened with my son, actually. Now, he's not in secondary. He's in primary. And he gets spellings every single week. And then he has a spelling test at the end of the week. So yesterday, he got a new list of words. And he came home and he said to us, I feel quite confident because we did this in lesson. Great. So we just gave him a quick quiz to see how he remembered things. And he struggled a bit. And there are three issues with that. One, like I said, it's a lack of time. The teacher can't go through those words every lesson all the time because they have lots of other things that they need to teach. Mm-hmm. And in secondary, that gets much, much worse. Another thing is something called familiarity with the content. So my son will have felt really confident in that classroom setting. You take him away from that and suddenly it's a bit different. And this is how memory works as well. This is why students might be able to answer, you know, questions in the classroom. You give them an exam and it feels different. So homework is a way to help them practice things in a different environment as well, giving them questions in a slightly different way. But also the last thing is forgetting. Forgetting is so important for learning. As they do something, as anybody does something, they are going to forget. And we need to help students to see forgetting is key. But because we don't have the time in lessons to keep coming back to things, it is up to the student really to do a bit of independent study. We also expect them to revise for exams at the end of secondary. How can we do that when we don't give them practice?
Teaching them the important discipline of independent study is also part of this. I hear you. Listen, many will agree with what you're saying, and it's a fascinating topic. And Joe, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about it. It's really interesting, and it isn't quite as black and white as good homework, bad homework, homework, is it? There's lots in between. Thank you so much for your time. Joe Castellino, who is head of science at a secondary school in Wakefield. She's author of The Homework Conundrum. Loads of you texting about this. 85058. We'll read some more of those after 8 o'clock this morning.
It is 5:28.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you. That is how I know you. Go on.
Keep it going.
That's your request, Rachel. That's
absolutely my request.
I think I'm going to have to talk over it. No, that's enough, Celine. Yes. Is this the greatest love story on a big ship since, well, that one? Two people have found love after being stuck on the Villa V Odyssey. The big cruise liner that was due to set sail from Belfast on May the 30th, but was delayed due to repairs taking longer than expected, much, much longer. Let's talk to Angela and Jeanne now. Good morning.
Good morning, Claire and Rachel.
Good morning.
It's great to have you on. Now, let's get this straight. You were both single when you boarded the ship, weren't you?
Yes, we were.
Okay. And how did love blossom?
Well, we're spending time on the ship and able to come there during the day, but had to go back to our hotels at night around Belfast. And we started walking together and created a very good friendship, and it kind of blossomed into a romance. We realized how compatible we were.
Oh, it's just such a lovely story. And you kind of bonded in a wider group. Is that right, Angela? I mean, you were just thrown into this situation where you didn't know how long you were going to be stuck there.
That's correct. We pretty much anticipated setting sail right away when we got out here to Belfast. And it has turned out that 4 months later, we are still here hoping to set sail maybe in a week. And through that delay, though, some pretty magical things happened in my personal life.
I'll say. And when did you think, pardon the pun, but hello, sailor, Jean is, I think, potentially more than friend material.
I think you're probably right, actually, because we have now a new recent engagement. It's went quite a bit farther than friendship.
Oh, my goodness. Many congratulations.
Thank you.
Jean, when did you think she's the woman for me?
You know, it actually happened a lot faster than I expected. It's kind of like what you read in a book or see in the movies. I've been in love before, but nothing like this. It just, we really are soulmates.
Oh, my goodness. Did either of you two come on board the ship? Because this is where you're going to be on the ship for several years, possibly for the rest of your lives, right? Did either of you two come on board intending to meet someone else?
No, not at all. Actually, I was kind of looking. I definitely was looking for an adventure of a lifetime. I just didn't know that that would mean falling in love before I even set sail, actually.
Oh, listen, Jean, I want to probe further. When you say you've been in love before, but not like this, what is this like?
I don't know, without it sounding too sappy, but it's kind of all-encompassing. We're just, we spend all our time together. We agree on everything. We're aligned on our goals. And, you know, as Angie said, coming onto a small ship and creating a relationship means you have to be really good friends because there's no place to hide.
Yeah. I mean, this is quite a test, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
For any relationship.
I'm not sure my marriage would survive a few weeks on a ship. Never mind blossom on it. Have you combined cabins, Rachel?
No, we haven't combined cabins for two reasons. The main one being that this is a sister trip for Angie. So her sister's joining us as well. And so they're going to keep that cabin, and Angie will split her time. Hopefully it'll be split equitably, which I'm sure it will be. But no, it's important for that. That trip is something that's really, really important to Angie, and I respect that. And we'll make it work.
Can I ask about the engagement? When did it happen? When did you get the ring? Is it all happened in Belfast?
Absolutely. Everything's happened in Belfast.
Yes.
What a great city.
Oh,
and where are you going to get married? Presumably on board, because the captain can marry you, can't he?
That's correct. We will get married on board, and we're actually going to get married in between Panama and Costa Rica, so the captain can marry us on board, and then we'll step off for probably a week or so in Costa Rica That's where Gianna has spent the last 6 years. So looking forward to a really good kind of a perpetual honeymoon, if I may, though, because we are going around the world on a cruise ship.
And never-ending honeymoon. Amazing.
There you go.
Just got to fix up your sister now, Angela. There's still time.
Thank you both.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Oh, I found that all quite overwhelming.
Yeah, beautiful.
If I'm honest. Right, let's get back to the news, shall we? Reluctantly. But here we go. Sir Keir Starmer will speak at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool later and will call on people to join a shared struggle to build a new Britain. The Prime Minister will admit there are no easy answers, but that there is light at the end of the tunnel. Pat McFadden, the Minister for the Cabinet Office, told us the government has to take tough decisions, such as cutting the winter fuel allowance for millions of pensioners.
Getting the public finances sorted is an inescapable duty of government. You just can't run away from it. And we know what happened when people tried to run away from it in the past. Everybody suffers when that happens. We will protect the value of the basic state pension through the triple lock. We will get the public finances sorted.
Israel says it's carried out more strikes on Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon as thousands of people flee north to escape the fighting. The Lebanese health ministry says nearly 500 people were killed by a wave of Israeli attacks yesterday. The Israeli military says it hit around 1,600 Hezbollah targets, but Lebanon says most of the sites were residential.
A former chief executive of Harrods has told the BBC he witnessed abhorrent behaviour by the former owner, Mohammed Fayed. James MacArthur, who ran the department store for 10 months in 2008, denied being aware of any sexual abuse. Dozens of women have come forward with allegations of being sexually assaulted or raped by Fayed, who died last year.
The number of illegally modified electric bikes confiscated by UK police forces rose significantly in the last year. 27 of 46 forces responded to a Freedom of Information request by the Press Association. More than 900 illegal e-bikes were seized, compared to 511 for the previous 12 months. Sergeant Stuart Ford leads the City of London Police Cycle Response Unit.
What they'll do is they'll go and buy a kit online with a throttle and a lithium battery, or sometimes two lithium batteries, and then a rear motor that fits on the rear wheel. And what they're doing by just holding the throttle open, these types of bikes will go up to sort of 30, 40 miles an hour quite easily. What they've done is they've actually turned it into a moped, which you need insurance for, which